I'm longtime journalist and brand new podcaster Meg Heckman, and this is Radio Free Dystopia, a podcast about what we learn when current events and dystopian fiction start to look the same. I'm here once again with my co-host, Toby Ball. Toby, how's your summer going?
It is going great. I'm in full-on summer mode.
Awesome. Well, that is perfect for the topic of this show, because this is a very special episode. We are in the middle of summer, and that means that we are also in the middle of peak summer reading season for adults, for kids, for everybody in between. And so we have put together a show for you today that is all about young adult dystopian fiction. So instead of the news from Dystopia, I am going to share a few voicemail recommendations that we received from listeners and also from a group of young women who Toby knows. Toby, do you want to tell us a little bit about the posse that you conferred with to get these recommendations?
Sure. It's basically my daughter and a couple of her friends when we were up on vacation. They're all big readers. Oh, and my niece, too. And they gave me the lowdown.
All right, great. Well, I'm going to go ahead and play a few of their suggestions right now.
Hi, my name is Sadie, and my favorite young adult dystopian novel is the Maximum Ride series. I feel like it's really good because it's kind of different from many dystopian novels, and it kind of shows a glimpse into the real world, and it also has hints of romance and sci-fi.
My name is Julia. My favorite dystopian novel is 1984 because it has a really complex plot and also doesn't have the super sappy love story, love triangle that a lot of the more modern ones do.
My name is Addie, and I like The Hunger Games because it was different from a lot of the other books that I read, and it had a really risky story plot to it.
All right, so those are some great suggestions, and I also like that there's a little dispute about the value of romantic undertones in a dystopian plot. And then our last listener recommendation is actually, it's from my friend Phil, who is a grade school teacher, and his son Avery.
So the book that we picked, me and my son, was a book called Rugosa, written by Creek Stewart. It's a dystopian young adult novel. Creek Stewart is a survivalist who has a facility out in the Midwest where he allows families to come and learn skills to live in the wild and live off the land and habitat building, and it's really a fantastic idea. He also has one of our favorite shows on TV called Fat Guys in the Woods, where he takes... It's on the Weather Channel, believe it or not, but he takes middle-aged men who have never left their apartments out in the middle of nowhere in harsh climates and teaches them to build shelters and light fires with what they have and all that kind of stuff, and it's great fun. But he decided to write this book, and we bought it, and my son, Avery, who is 9 years old in fourth grade, who loves these type of books, read it, and... he would like to talk about it. So, Avery, could you go over a little bit about what the book is about without giving out anything?
Well, the main part of the book is that this boy is traveling into a dystopian city to save his friend. And it's a really good book because he has to use survival skills and he can't get caught by this dystopian gang that's,
are they like the rulers?
The WUG, which is the World Union Government, and it recruits states to its organization, and the World Union Government in the book tries to take over the world. And Rugosa is only the first book in this series. The author is planning on writing a second book.
And a third, I believe, but... do you know what led up to this, where, like, the world is in chaos and in ruins? Did something happen in the book, or is it just after that?
It's just after that.
Okay, so you don't really know what happened?
You don't really know what actually happens when you read the book that starts the whole dystopian city thing.
But is there, like, modern day things like cars that are still working and stores or...
No, not at all. The World Union government, when they recruit the states, controls all food rations. They control where people go. You have to have a passport to go out of your state, and you have to tell them where you're going. And they destroy cities, and vehicles that are not authorized to go anywhere will be arrested, and all people who disobey the WUG will be arrested, executed, or executed.
Okay, so the boy, he's the protagonist?
The boy is the protagonist. The WUG is the antagonist.
Right, so he's trying to
save
avoid
his friend.
Them and save his friend from what? This organization?
This organization. And his friend went to the city, which is the dystopian target right now, mm-hmm. before it happened, and then she got caught up in it. And he has a friend over there, and, he's all... Well, the boy is a Boy Scout, and then his friend is an Eagle Scout who he's never actually seen.
Oh. What do you think about this type of book, this type of... this dystopian future type book? Is that a good... is it, like, good action in it? Is it something you enjoy? Is it something that scares you?
It's something that I enjoy, but don't think for a second that it doesn't really scare me, because this could happen. Like, it is a big possibility in our future.
Why do you think that?
I think that because there are some people who are just power hungry and want to control things, and that can lead up to making big organizations that can lead to dystopian places.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think we could do to avoid that?
I think what we could do to avoid that is try and get rid of power-hungry people like terrorists and put them in custody, and try not to have a lust for power.
Okay. So would you recommend this book?
Yes, I would recommend this book to all young readers and
who
want to be prepared for the future. Yes, and definitely adults.
Did you learn any survival skills from it?
Yes, I learned tons of survival skills from it.
Can you recall one?
Well, one that I can recall is how to make coded messages. Like, if you're with a group, mm-hmm. and, like, a coded, like, language.
Yeah.
That people can't not write.
Oh, awesome. And, they, like, can't decipher, you mean?
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. So rate it 5 stars, do you think?
I would actually kind of rate it 4 stars. I think it could have been a little bit better. But other than that, it's a really great book, and I recommend it to everybody.
What do you think could have been better about it?
What I think could be better about it is that it could have some more past in it leading up to the...
Some more backstory?
Yeah, some more backstory.
They might get into that in the second book. You don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
That might be a possibility that I think would help the series. But, yeah, otherwise, I think it's a great book. And everybody that's mature enough to read it should read it.
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bye. Thank you for your time.
Okay, so I think Phil and Avery need their own podcast.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Yeah. But I mean, I think Avery makes a really good point about why kids and young people and adults are maybe so attracted to this genre. There's that specter that if we don't do something differently now, we could end up in that situation in the future. And I talked to somebody else who has a pretty interesting perspective on why young adult dystopian novels are so popular. And she has written a dystopian novel of her own. Her name is Susan Moger. And she's also an old friend of yours too, Toby, right?
She's a family friend. I've known her since I was born, essentially. Early on, when I was starting to write and she was starting to write, we were sort of writing partners, exchanging pieces. So I read some earlier parts of drafts of the book that eventually became Of Better Blood, which is the book that that was published last year, I think.
Okay. Yeah. And so Susan and I had a great conversation a couple days ago, and I'm going to play a slightly edited version of that right now. And Toby, you'll be pleased to know I did not ask her to send us any baby pictures of you to put out on
That's
social
awesome.
Media.
That would have been dystopian in itself.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for asking me.
Yeah. So I'm about halfway through your book, and it's absolutely fantastic. And I'm not even the intended audience. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about Of Better Blood and what you were going for when you were writing it?
Of Better Blood really started as an adult novel, but Rowan, the narrator, who's 16, really took over that book. And so at some point, I just decided to make it Rowan's story. And Rowan is a survivor of polio, which in talking to a YA audience, you kind of have to explain that it was an infectious disease that really, in 1916 and 17, for the next two or three years after 1916, was an epidemic in the northeastern United States. Mm-hmm. Polio was everywhere, but this epidemic attacked not just poor people who were blamed for spreading the disease, but privileged people. It didn't matter. It had no, it didn't seem to play favorites in any way. So Rowan, who's from a very privileged family, 5 years before the events in the novel, gets polio and has suffered for 5 years. Getting better, she's now able to walk with a crutch, but her family has rejected her. Her privileged family has kind of ignored her and allowed things to happen, like being warehoused in a home for crippled children and deprived their company, really. But Rowan, she's the narrator, and in the course of the novel, she discovers the dark side of eugenics, which was a popular social movement based on false science and popular from late 19th century up through the 1930s in the United States. So eugenics believers labeled anyone with a chronic disease or mental, emotional, or physical disabilities as unfit. And that's a word that comes up a lot in the novel. And Rowan actually, I think, feels that she's unfit. She's certainly labeled that way by people in the novel, but transformed by a friendship with a girl definitely from the other side of the tracks from where Rowan grew up. Dorchie is also 16, but she grew up in carnivals and traveling from place to place with her parents, who died in 1918 in another epidemic, the Spanish flu. But it's a friendship with Dorchie that really is a spark that gets Rowan out of her rut of being rejected and feeling unfit and gives her courage to, first of all, have a friend, and then to kind of do things to better her situation.
Right, and that's kind of the chemistry between those two characters is very much that moment of awakening that exists in so many dystopian novels. Even though this book doesn't take place in a dystopia like 1984 or Fahrenheit 451, but there are dystopian themes in what seems an awful lot like real life America during the first half of the 20th century. Yeah. How much of this book was based on factual events?
Well, the impetus for the book was a family story which a female relative of mine who I knew my whole life until she died when I was an adult, had been rejected by her father as a cripple when she was 10 years old and had spent 6 years improving from having been paralyzed with polio at age 4. So she's 10 years old and she's gone through a lot of operations. And on her 10th birthday, her father told her, "I never wanted a crippled daughter." She told me that when she was 70 or so, and it made a lasting impression on me. I really wanted to explore that family dynamic. And the more I learned about that era, she was 10 in 1922, so I feel like her family was, or not her family, but her father was influenced by the eugenics of the time. It was everywhere, and people just kind of accepted it as you were better than people who had these disabilities, and they should not be allowed to have children. Now, an infectious disease wouldn't keep you necessarily label you as being unfit, but the fact that you got the disease, people thought if you were susceptible, there was something in your background that made you weak enough to be infected, so maybe you shouldn't have children.
Wow. So again, a lot of those themes of class and kind of the othering that happens in a lot of more traditional dystopian stories. That's
yeah.
So what else is fact and what else is fiction in the book?
Well, you, since you're in the middle, you haven't gotten to the part three is fictional dystopia on an island off the coast of Maine. Mm-hmm. And that is fictional.
Okay.
And that was, it seemed to me, a logical extension of the factual parts about eugenics, which were that in order to have a really strong country, we need to only let people have children who have the best genes to pass on. And they didn't use the word gene because they weren't really aware of how it worked. But eugenicists were adamant that, as in breeding good cattle, you could really weed out the people like you could weed out the cattle who shouldn't be having children. That part, that's factual. And the parts of the book that are fictional in the first two parts of the book that are fictional is the unfit family show, the carnival, or the state fair sideshow that was called the Unfit Family Show is fictional, but it seemed to me a logical extension of the fit family exhibits and the fitter family questionnaires that were promulgated at state fairs and county fairs all through the 20s.
Oh, wow.
So there, you would go to eugenics. There might be a sign over the tent or the building on the state fair property, and you'd hear lectures about who should be having children. You'd answer questions about your family. That part is all true. I just decided that they would also have a play that showed what happened when unfit people had children. So that's where the show that Rowan ends up representing a cripple, in quotes,
mm-hmm.
Daughter of these unfit parents.
And it kind of shows what believers in eugenics saw as this grim future if unfit people were allowed to procreate, correct?
Yes, and in an exaggerated way, but in fact, that's absolutely what people believed.
Wow.
Could happen.
So why do you think books with dystopian themes are so popular among young adults?
Well, I anticipated this question, and I listened to an interview with Paolo Bacigalupi. Are you familiar with his books?
I'm not.
Oh, well, he wrote The Wind Up Girl is an adult novel, and The Water Knife, which is I think came out 2 years ago, is another adult novel. But in between, he wrote Dystopian, young adult novel, Shipbreaker, won the YA Prince Award in 2011. And Shipbreaker was one of my go-to books whenever I felt stuck or, you know, I just thought, how did Paolo get people in and out of these situations? So it's a near future dystopia. Mm-hmm. And I listened to some interviews that he had talking about his novels and how he would characterize them. And he kind of felt the way I did, which is, you know, you could define young adult books that might be labeled dystopian in a lot of other ways too. Apocalyptic or historical, like mine. He was less worried about the label on it, but he was very interested in giving, you know, not depressing his readers, but also not sugarcoating anything. And I think that these near future books, which, so for young adult readers, they could actually imagine themselves 20 years hence. Mm-hmm. Plus, they're not maybe more knowledgeable about the state of the world and threats like global warming than other generations were. I think the appeal is to have first of all, have adults telling you something that you might already fear, acknowledging the fear, and also giving some hope.
Wow, so fear.
So I didn't mean to go off on Paolo. I do recommend Shipbreaker to anyone. I think because it seems like adults are acknowledging fears about the future, which many other adults aren't. So these authors are appealing. And then there are, you know, in every case, and in lots of cases, girls are being the ones who are triumphant. Mm-hmm. Hunger Games, Divergent, Trilogy.
Right. And that's fairly recent, right?
Yeah.
And awesome. Yeah. So what made you choose female protagonists in your own book?
Well, I guess I never considered another protagonist for this book because I was writing about the relationship between a father and a daughter. I started with that relationship. So, my relative was a girl, so that just seemed like a logical thing. But also, kind of as a feminist, that was what I wanted to do. But my book is called Historical. It's in the library. It's shelved under Historical.
Okay.
But it does have this dystopian element to it. And the whole eugenics history is pretty dystopian.
Right.
People were thinking they were living in one country, and maybe they had an operation when they were in the hospital at some point. They weren't told they were being sterilized. And so at some later point in life, they realize, no, it wasn't an ordinary country I was living in. I was living in this dystopian world where I could just be operated on without knowledge.
And that tracks with some of the other work that you've done. One of your other books is about teaching the Diary of Anne Frank, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. What sorts of themes, if any, did you draw from that work for this novel?
What really came through to me and what I wrote as an introduction to teachers in teaching the Diary of Anne Frank is that it was ordinary people. It wasn't, you know, there weren't monsters who suddenly came into Germany and made Nazis and carried out their plans. It could never have happened without ordinary people ignoring, closing their eyes, or even, you know, under thinking it was expedient to go along. And that really made me think about this book, how it's so easy to just ignore what's happening and in current events.
Right.
Go along, see what happens, keep your head down, like all people in 1984, except for the hero and others.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for your time. This was absolutely fantastic.
Thanks, Meg.
Yeah. If people want to find you on Twitter, where should they go?
I'm on Twitter at Susan Moger, M-O-G-E-R.
That's great. And the book is Of Better Blood. And yes. You can find that at your favorite local bookstore or wherever you buy books. So, Toby, what did you think of what Susan had to say about why dystopian fiction is so popular among young adults these days?
You know, I'm just, you know, guessing from having been around, you know, my kids and their friends and stuff. But I do think there's a strange sense of maybe helplessness among that age group in that they're old enough to kind of understand what's going on in the world around them. But, you know, obviously too young to vote, too young to do things that an adult would probably be able to do or at least have the potential to do to try and make changes. So I think, you know, dystopian fiction, I think, might address that sort of, you know, anxiety. And I think that kind of came out a little bit. In the review that we heard about Rugosa, there are imaginable situations that, you know, are dystopian, and it is, I don't know if it's cathartic or what it is, but to read about, you know, particularly kids resisting, I think is compelling.
Yeah, you're right. Part of the draw of these types of stories is that they give kids a vocabulary, kids and young people a vocabulary to talk about current events. And I think the first time that I really understood this was, oh gosh, 6 or 7 years ago. And, you know, I don't talk about my day job a whole lot on the podcast, but I'm a journalism professor. And so that means I spend a lot of my days interacting with, you know, 19, 20, 21-year-olds. It's great. I have the best job ever. And the first time that I ever taught a college journalism class, I was a one-off course that I was teaching. I was not a full-time faculty member. And it just happened to be the same semester that Osama bin Laden was killed. You know, that happened on a Sunday night. President Obama went out and made the announcement late on a Sunday night. And I happened to be teaching my class first thing Monday morning. This was a while ago. So these students were old enough to remember 9/11. I mean, so it's not like now where they were in pre-kindergarten and have no real memory of it. So these kids had this really visceral experience as young adults. And I remember going into the classroom and just asking them all to kind of write down what they were thinking and what they were feeling, both about just the fact that this had happened, the news coverage. Probably 3/4 of the class referenced Harry Potter, how they saw this as, you know, the equivalent of Voldemort finally dying. And that really kind of cemented for me the power of fictional stories to help kids understand things. I do wonder, you know, is there a flip side to that? And I don't know.
As far as what?
I mean, clearly this is a genre I love. You love it. We wouldn't be doing this podcast. Like, we both find it interesting. But is the popularity of this type of books, is even doing this podcast kind of embracing a sort of fatalist attitude and encouraging a fatalist attitude about the future? I don't know.
I don't think so. In that, I think a guy like Orwell, you know, he writes 1984 not as a, well, I guess we're screwed, but as a, you know, this is a potential future that we want to avoid. I think at its best, it's not necessarily, I don't know. I guess it's empowering through helping you see where the potential for trouble may lie. You know, I would say, just when you were saying what was the flip side, you know, I think that's the one thing that, you know, particularly young adult dystopia, but I think dystopia in general has, is that there's some, you know, 1984 is not exactly an uplifting ending, but there's a sense that he's trying to resist, right?
Right.
And I think the alternative would be like, there's not like a big young adult noir movement.
What would that even look like?
I don't know. But noir is usually like these guys who are trying really hard and just eventually just get ground down and crushed.
Yeah.
And I think there's not a big appetite for things about, you know, young adults who try really hard but eventually just get stomped on. So I think there is a, you know, there's an empowerment piece to all this for young adults. And I think most of these, and in, you know, Susan talks about it, you know, the characters are young adults. The characters are often young adults who are resisting adults.
Yeah, and probably also coming to terms with the understanding that your parents and the other adults in your life are fallible. And that's,
right.
I remember being young and that kind of being a mental jump. So, Toby, you have kids. How do you or do you talk to them about difficult themes in the books that they're reading?
That's a good question. I a lot of the stuff they read, I haven't read.
Okay.
You can get a basic sense of these things, but I don't, you know, so much of what they read or like my daughter will read, I think it's not particularly ideological, in that most of the issues are more sort of moral choices or, you know, things about control.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the Hunger Games, I think that's kind of two different sort of themes is like the moral choices that Katniss has to make, and then also sort of the way in which, you know, the population is controlled and how she tries to undermine that and stuff like that. You know, I think later, I know The Giver is one that people read. Mm-hmm. I remember one that I read in, we read Atlas Shrugged? It was the other one. The Fountainhead. We read The Fountainhead.
Because Atlas Shrugged, that's the one that weighs like 13 pounds or something ridiculous
right.
like that. Yeah.
So we read The Fountainhead, which is, you know, it's Ayn Rand, so it's coming from a particular political mm-hmm. standpoint, and they don't, I don't think they read it now in high school. Yeah, so I think there's different kinds of books, you know, require different kinds of conversations, mm-hmm. and at least with my kids, they read so freaking much that it's a little hard to keep track of.
Right. That's a nice problem to have. Yeah.
Right, right. And I keep track of like making sure that the you know, what they're reading is appropriate for their age and stuff. But as far as teasing out like what every book, the sort of, you know, moral and political problems that may or may not come up, you know, it's a little bit hard to keep up, which makes me sound like a completely negligent father, but it's the truth.
All right. So you mentioned The Giver, and that reminded me that we got a couple of emails and tweets from listeners with some other book titles to recommend. I'm going to run down those really quickly. Mary on Twitter recommended a book called Knots and Crosses by, it's either Mallory or Mallory Blackman. And then Sally sent us an email with a long list of books. She also mentioned The Giver, which I also read and loved. And I've heard that the movie adaptation is pretty good, too. She recommends Feed by M.T. Anderson. Ready Player One.
Yeah, I've heard that's very good.
Yeah, and that's by Ernest Cline. And, you know, I don't think I realized that was a YA novel, because my brother-in-law, Mike Nothnagel, who was on one of our earlier episodes, he recommended that one too. So that's got a couple of thumbs up there.
Both my son and my nephew read it at like age 15, I guess, and loved it.
Okay. And it's basically like video games are dystopian, but might also save the world, correct?
Yeah. I don't know the real, I think it's kind of like the Da Vinci Code, but with 80s video games.
Oh, that sounds awesome, actually. Rot and Ruin is another one that Sally recommends, and the author of that is Jonathan Mabry.
Oh, yeah. He writes a lot of adult zombie novels.
Well, that explains why the book is called Rot and Ruin.
Yeah, there you go.
Uglies by Scott Waterfield. Cinder by Marissa Mayer. Or Mayer, and I'm guessing that is not the Marissa Mayer who heads up Yahoo. And
yeah,
then
I think my daughter read that.
Okay. Yeah, so thank you, Sally, for those recommendations. And again, if any of you listening have other recommendations or suggestions, just tweet them to us at RF Dystopia or send us an email and we'll share them on social media or mention them in an upcoming episode. But speaking of recommendations for great and perhaps slightly unknown YA novels and some YA dystopian novels that'll be coming out this fall, Toby went to the perfect expert on this. Toby, you want to talk to us a little bit about the conversation you had?
Sure. I talked to Liberty Hardy, who is read more books than any other two people I know. And she's a great advocate for books. She reads so many that you can basically say, oh, I like these four books. She'll be like, oh, you got to read this and this and this and this. I got in touch with her and she agreed to talk.
Okay, great. Well, I am going to play that interview right now.
I'm Liberty Hardy. I am a contributing editor for the site Book Riot. I am the host of All the Books, a podcast about new releases, as well as the host of All the Backlist, a podcast about books that are not new. And I'm a Book of the Month judge.
When we decided we were going to do a young adult dystopian novel episode, I knew that I had to interview Liberty because she has read like five times as many books as anybody else I know, or actually any two people put together. so her reading is completely comprehensive. Liberty, you know, one of the things I figured as far as people who are interested enough to listen to a podcast episode about young adult dystopian fiction is that they've probably done a fair amount of reading in that genre themselves. And I was hoping that maybe you would have a few books that maybe flew under the radar a little bit, but that you thought were good.
Absolutely. I'm going to start with, I was trying to think of the first dystopian fiction book that I read that I could remember. And I think it was After the Bomb by Gloria Miklowitz. Came out in 1985. And it scared me to death because everyone was afraid of the Cold War and nuclear war, and it is in fact about a town where a nuclear bomb has dropped and like the aftermath and all the people, you know, dealing with that. And it just scared me to death. I think I was like 9 when I read it. And then this one might not be under the radar, but it was for me. For some reason, I had never heard of it until the movie came out a couple years ago, but it's Z for Zachariah by Robert O'Brien.
Yeah, it's I think about... I've heard of that.
Yeah, well, they made it into a movie.
Okay.
But it's about there's a nuclear war and not a lot of people left. And there's a teenage girl. She's like living in the woods by herself. And there she gets two visitors, like two men show up at the same time. And one is very, very bad and one is not so bad. And like she's not alone any longer and she doesn't like it. But I hear that they romanticized it in the movie, like made it sort of like a love triangle. But it's actually pretty scary in the book. And I don't know, I had never heard of it when I was a kid. So I read that recently and thought it was really great. There's Enclave by Anne Aguirre. It's about people who have to live underground because of a nuclear war. And there's a bunch of young people running around who get jobs going topside to look for things. But there's also some people who are changing because of the fallout and turning into scary creatures living underground with the other people. And Neil Schusterman is an amazing author. His most recent one is called Scythe, which I absolutely loved. But he has a series. It's the Unwind series. And it's like a 5-book series. And it's about the United States after the Second Civil War has taken place. They've decided that parents can unwind their children between the ages of 13 and 18 if they decide that their trouble or they can't afford to like have this big a family or anything. So like you're born and everything's good till you're 13. And then when you turn 13, if you act out or, you know, your parents go broke, they can have you unwound, which is basically like putting you down. So you have to like be on your best behavior between those years, which is.
So it's like they kill you if you.
Basically,
if you
act- yeah. They give your parts to other people who need them. You're done. That's it.
Wow.
So don't mouth off.
So that's like the opposite of the Amish who like send the kids out to just go berserk for a couple years and decide if they want to stay being Amish or not.
Exactly.
All right.
There's a really amazing Amish zombie novel that I read recently, which we should talk about sometime. But let's talk about other zombies.
Well, you can't tease it like that.
I've just forgotten the title.
Okay.
So I'll tell you about probably my favorite zombie book of the last, 10 years. It's a series by Carrie Ryan. It's called The Forest of Hands and Teeth. And it's after there's been war and a plague, and now there are zombies, and the world is mostly covered in zombies. There's like a village where all these people live. It's like fenced in, and it's been going on for so long that like the kids who were born there don't know what life was like outside of these walls. So it's been like 100-something years, and there's a breach in the wall. So they have to try and like fend for themselves out in the world now, like not having grown up, like having seen anything out there. It's pretty awesome. And the Amish zombie book is called The Hallowed Ones by Laura Bickel. I couldn't remember the name of it, but I just remember that it was awesome.
The Hallowed Ones?
The Hallowed Ones, yeah.
And how do you spell Bickel? Is it Biggle?
It's Bickle. Bickle.
All right. Awesome.
Like Travis.
From Taxi Driver?
Yes.
Awesome.
My references are all super old because I am also super old. My last pick for books that have come out that might have flown under the radar is called Love in the Time of Global Warming by Francesca Leah Block. It's a reimagining of the Odyssey set in post-apocalyptic Los Angeles after the big quake shakes the country apart.
Yeah, that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
And
I love a dystopia.
So what age would that be good for?
It's definitely teens. These are all like, 12 to 18 or, 14 to 18, depending on how mature the person is. But okay. Also great for adults.
Yeah, I'm thinking that my daughter's 12th birthday is coming up. And that one sounds like kind of up her alley.
So would you like to hear about some books that are coming up?
I would love to hear about that. Okay.
It's funny because, I think that like YA is a much bigger phenomenon, and we've also just started labeling it YA in the last 10 years. There are a lot of books that like fall under that category that we read when we were kids. But a lot of the future YA and a lot of recent YA, like sci-fi, is more like computer oriented and technology oriented. A couple of these are definitely fit that bill. One is called Warcross by Marie Lu, which is LU. It comes out on September 12th, and it's about a virtual reality video game called Warcross, and it becomes a worldwide obsession. Like it's been out for like 10 years, and basically everybody just plays the game all the time, does things to get money, to do things in the game. There's big worldwide competitions, and it's like, what was that thing that lasted for like 5 seconds last year? Like the Pokemon thing.
Yeah,
like imagine like that actually like took off forever and everyone just kept doing it. It's like that. There's one called, I really liked this one a lot because I like words. It's called All Rights Reserved by Gregory Scott Tetsulis. I don't actually know how to pronounce his name. It comes out on August 29th, and it's about the future where everything you do and say is copyrighted. So if you say the word sorry, you have to pay somebody $10. And if you nod your head, somebody's copyrighted that move, you have to pay them a certain amount of money. So basically, kids get a free pass until they're 15, and then they have to start like paying out for everything that they do and say. And if you don't watch what you're doing, you can run up like huge debts doing this. And then your family, is very poor and you have to like work it off. And there's this one girl who's coming up on her last, day of freedom, and she decides that she's not going to talk at all when she turns 15. She's going to, like, keep her family out of debt by not speaking. And it's, like, a big deal. Everybody can't believe, like, she's, like, the first person to think of doing this. It's really cool, though. It's, like, really fun. It's a fun thing to think about. Did you ever watch How I Met Your Mother? I think that was the show.
I think I watched maybe an episode or two.
So, the Jason Segel?
Yep.
I've never seen the show, but I know he's from it. He's turned himself into an author. He's had a couple of like middle grade books out recently, and now he's trying for the young adult age with a book called Otherworld that he co-wrote with Kirsten Miller. It comes out on Halloween, And it's sort of like a Westworld or Black Mirror kind of book where life is virtual reality. Like, there's no controllers or, you know, screens or anything. Like, life has worked, it's been worked out so that everything that you could ever want and all the weirdness that you could ever want to try out, like, just happens for you. But of course, you know, that's not always good. So I have one more for you.
All right.
It's called Rebel Soul, S-E-O-U-L. And it's by Axie. It's A-X-I-E-O-H. It comes out on September 15th. And it takes place in East Asia in 2199. And people are trying to rebuild their cities after a great war that has left the East Pacific in ruins. And they're recruiting young people to help man these government-built massive war robots. So it's kind of like Pacific Rim.
Cool. So before we go, what is your sort of like all-time fave in the dystopian genre?
Oh, you know, I should have thought of this before I came on the show.
I wanted to spring it on you.
I don't know. Maybe, possibly, I think we could call Library at Mount Char dystopia. Does it have to be a young adult novel?
No. Just like any.
Okay. Did you read Library at Mount Char?
Well, and who's that by?
It's by Scott Hawkins. It's my obsession. I've read it 10 times since it came out 2 years ago. It's this crazy, weird, super violent novel about gods and a different America and lions. It's crazy. I'm a bit obsessed with it.
Liberty, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For doing this. You're the only person who could have done it. You're the only
I'm always
person.
Happy to talk about books, always.
Right.
It means I'm not sitting at home just talking to my cats.
Right. Well, that much I know. So, how can people find you on Twitter?
Miss Liberty, M-I-S-S Liberty.
Yeah, great suggestions there. Thanks for doing that interview, Toby. We are just about out of time. If people want to find you online, where should they go?
They can find me on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm also on the Crime Writers On podcast. And just this past week, I was a guest on a podcast called The Blotter Presents. And we talked about a couple of really terrible documentaries about H.H. Holmes, America's first serial killer.
Oh, okay.
Who surprisingly is from Gilmanton, New Hampshire.
Isn't that also Peyton Place?
I thought that was Wolfboro.
No, I'm pretty sure it was Gilmington.
Or
because they called, they called the author Pandora in Blue Jeans. That town, wow. Yeah, wow, okay,
that's a lot of stuff going down in Gilmington.
Gilmington, wow, that's a. Wow. All right. So if anyone wants to find me on Twitter, I am at @Meg_Heckman. You can also find me on Instagram at @MegHeckman, no underscore. The show is on Twitter at @RFDystopia. You can send us an email at radiofreedystopia@gmail.com or check out our website and leave a comment there, radiofreedystopia.com. Until next time, this is Radio Free Dystopia. Partners in crime media.